Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smart Firefighting Podcast. In this fourth part of the four-part series around fentanyl, we're going to dive into decon and closing thoughts. In regards to decon, we're going to look at what are some of the easy tips and common sense rules that first responders can use to make sure that they're properly decontaminating themselves after a fentanyl scene. That ranges from changing uniforms, showering, using water and soap in your hands, to understanding what are the biggest threats in regards to decontamination. We're going to dive into Narcan and what you can do with Narcan during and after a scene or also a patient. And then also give some final thoughts in terms of not only what are some of the things that we're pessimistic about, but things that we're optimistic about in terms of this fight against the opioid crisis that is unfortunately taking away a generation of Americans. We hope you enjoy listening and take care. Maybe try and cover one last part of this discussion. I think we've done a great job talking about PPE. We talked a lot about the detection. We haven't really hit on decon. Do you guys want to maybe touch a little bit on some of the aspects of how to properly deal with the scene in terms of the decon process, or is that something that
we can?
Yeah. Talk about it now. I think that's important.
To me, I think the first stage of decon for especially for those people that may come into contact on their hands. I like to use the example undercover drug buyer. If you're an undercover officer and we put you in PPE before you go to do a drug buy, chances are good you're not going to be successful.
There are stupid crooks out there.
You can wear a
DEA rate jack and buy dope. It has been done. I will tell you that.
I'm not surprised. However, I think your success rate will drop. So I would personally, if I was going out to do the drug buy and I may have the material in my hand, the first thing I'm going to do is get water on that as soon as I can, just to get it off my hand. Now, Mike, you had a great idea with just having...
A friend of ours, Maddie Gutwell. Maddie Gutwell is president of the New England Narcotics Officers Association. And he came up with the idea as an undercover, if you're making a hand-to-hand buy in a car, a couple things you got to be concerned about. One, we talked about the aerosolization of the fentanyl. So turn your air conditioning off, turn your heating off, keep your windows up. It's getting as hot as heck, but you know, you got to deal with it. When you come in, and traditionally when you're doing heroin deals, guys would spit it in their hand and hand it to you. It's kind of disgusting, but this is what they do. So we're talking low-level street type of dealers. Now the bad guys are doing different types of things. You know, they're putting in something they're handing it to. It's double bagged. But if you take, there's two different things you can do to take custody of. One, you can have, for example, we have a coffee cup here. You have two cups in your car. One coffee cup contains soapy water, and we'll talk about that in a second. The other coffee cup, you have a lid that maybe tape on the top. You take your evidence at the bad guy exits, you seal it inside there. So you're not getting anything that's on the outside here. Then you have another coffee cup that has soapy water in there, and you can wash your hands right then and there as you're driving away. Make sure your cover team has naloxone or Narcan that, you know, if something does happen. So, I mean, that's as an undercover. A friend of ours, as I mentioned, Matty Gutwell, what he said, he actually builds a pouch and talks to undercovers about that. And I mean, building a pouch is taking duct tape. If you do a walk up on the street, you do a hand-to-hand, you slide that into your pocket. And with that duct tape, it actually seals it in there. That way, it's not in your trouser pocket where you pull it out. There's a chance you can have a rip. It's actually sealed up in the duct tape. So, I mean, there's a lot of investigators out there that are coming up with some brilliant ideas about how to protect their undercovers. Same thing with informants. So you have to deal with informants that are going to be doing the hand-to-hand. You have to have a cover team of Narcan to protect them. So, I mean, there's some just common sense rules that are out there but you have to do them. If you know how to do it. Because the day you don't do it, the day someone's going to get injured.
I think
that's important.
And so one thing that we have to remember then is as we go on, even an overdose call, when we get that patient where we need to get them, I think that anybody who has done the overdose run should go and change their uniform if there was any outward material. Now, if there was somebody who was an injection user, probably don't have to. But what I want to make sure is if there was any chance that powder was transferred to your uniform, I would like to see you change your uniform, get that uniform washed, and take a shower just to make sure you get the material off of you. And we don't want you to bring that material home. We all remember that there's been a couple of different instances where people have inhaled material because they wiped it off their uniform, not thinking about what it was. And we would all do that. So if you came into contact with somebody and it was powder, I want you to get out of that uniform and get it washed. So Now, you notice that we're only saying soap and water when we're talking about people and skin. We want to focus on soap and water, and that is it on skin. Now, the next step is if we need to destroy material. So let's say that we had the patient, they were on the bathroom floor in their home, and there's a family living in that apartment still. What are we gonna do? Well, if they have powder, chances are good that we can oxidize that powder. So the nice thing about fentanyl is it's easy to destroy. Now, to destroy it, there's a lot of different things that we can use to oxidize it. Now, when we start out, the thing that works, one of the best things we have is a product called peracetic acid, which frankly is no different than having vinegar mixed in with hydrogen peroxide. Okay, so not your brown bottle of hydrogen peroxide you get at the store, that's too low of a concentration. It will work, it'll just take a lot longer time. But what we'll want is something like the hydrogen peroxide you could get at the hair salon. Okay, so it's about 12% there versus 5%, 3% when you get in the brown bottle at home. So what I want to do is get that peracetic acid or hydrogen peroxide and acetic acid on it, and that will destroy it really quickly. The commercial product that you can buy that is probably what I found for the fastest to destroy is a product called Dahlgren Decon. And you can buy that from First Line Technology or from Federal Resources. And that product works very efficiently at destroying fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. There are other products out there that do work as well. The one that I've worked more with than others is Decon 7. Works a little bit slower. And it's a peroxide-based one. It doesn't have that acetic acid added, and it has a couple of other things in there, but still works very well, just not as fast, okay? So if speed is your issue, then you go here. Now, you could also use something like bleach. Now, bleach, if you leave it on it for 30 minutes, will destroy it, but it takes time. And the reason behind that, and this gets a little bit sciencey, but the whole premise behind what works and what doesn't work for destroying the material is pH dependent. So if we look at a material and its pH is less than 7, that usually works much faster than that same material that has had its pH up to 9 or 10. And that's why bleach takes the longest, because bleach has the higher pH. Decon 7 is the next higher pH, and then Dahlgren at the lower pH. And it's really a pH-driven process. The only way to change that is to alter the pH of your solution and to make it work faster. Again, very much materials that are considered oxidizers. So now there is a process out there that some people recommend using a product called OxyClean, which is a laundry detergent type of material. Now, will OxyClean work? Yes, it will work. But it takes a long time. And the reason, when they were doing that study, they were using it on surfaces that had already been cleaned up. And then they were using it for a half an hour sitting down there to destroy any residual material. So if you're dealing with something like that, you're talking about a laboratory surface that is non-porous, and you've already cleaned up the bulk material, then that would be fine. But if you're dealing with an emergency response situation where you might have powder material, I'm going to recommend that whatever you do, I personally would rather see you use Dahlgren Decon for the fast or Decon 7 and completely make sure that all the material is completely saturated with it. And make sure then that you sit, and if I tell you it's 5 minutes, I want you to wait 10.
Sorry, is this a spray process?
So you can spray it, you can pour it. Now, that brings up another issue then. If you spray it, or if you pour it, remember, we're dealing with a particle that likes to go airborne. So any sprayer, I don't care if it's one of the sprayers that has a really nice mist, or the standard sprayer we use that we buy at Home Depot that's a pesticide sprayer, all of those, when you first turn on the sprayer, have what I scientifically call a puff of air. So it starts out with a little air burst that comes out before the liquid comes out. That air burst is enough in the pesticide sprayers. We have sent material over 8 feet against a wall So I always say, if you're going to use a sprayer to deploy the material, please don't start spraying directly at the material. Spray at the surface or spray above what you're trying to do and let it fall down and get that mist. Also, when you're setting the sprayer, go with the fan, the most dispersed pattern, so you don't have pressure coming behind it. Because remember, anytime you have pressure, you're going to move the material. So it's all about, and I think probably, Evan, you've done more decon studies, I would say, than anybody in the U.S. today. Mm-hmm. The only other person that I've seen doing studies is a girl, Michaela, I can't remember her last name, out of Queensland University of Technology, mm-hmm. who for Department of Defense is doing all the time profile studies right now, which is saying what's the exact time and mole-to-mole ratio mm-hmm. you need. But Evan's probably the person we send everybody to get decon guidance.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right in that. It's you want that wide broadcast spray to knock it down to get as much intimate contact with the material as possible, but also think that kind of fire extinguisher approach like you talked about. You don't just go straight at the middle of the flame right off the bat. You hit the edge or hit the bottom or the top and work toward it. And yeah, just like you spoke about, the pH really is kind of everything, and the time at which you want to do this. And all the products do both of that surface decontamination, where there may have just been trace and now you're making sure in that home that it's nice and safe now, or you had the entire pile sitting on some type of lab bench or table that you've got to clean up, and you've got to also decide what to do with that bulk material after you've taken your sample and put it into your chain of custody from that crime scene. How do you contain it? Do you need to keep a large amount of sample? You probably don't need to keep 15 grams if you can avoid it. So maybe decon the powder or just
And I like to say, if you're taking a sample, so let's say we're taking a sample like Mike had told us earlier, and we're going to double bag that sample, and then we're going to put it in a non-crush container, right?
All right.
I like to tell people, consider wiping the mm-hmm. outside of the double bag mm-hmm. with a decontaminant solution, just because if somebody doesn't realize what's in there later on down that chain of custody, when they go to do destruction of the property, we want to make sure that they don't come into contact with the material. So I like to just do a quick wipe down on the outside of the materials before you do that final packing.
And also, I think if you're going to submit as evidence, you can use stickers such as we have right here, caution suspected fentanyl. And it has, you know, it has the DOT skull and crossbones. You see that, you know it's not good stuff.
Yeah.
So be very careful on that. I think that's very important that you notify that it's suspected fentanyl. And I can tell you right now, from a lab seizure we had, a guy was manufacturing Siegfried fentanyl, and I was contacted the next day from an investigator, and he said, yeah, we think we have a fentanyl lab here. Can you come take a look at it? And I'm like, okay, you have any evidence? Go, yeah, it's on its way to the crime lab right now. And I go, did you mark suspected fentanyl on it? This is back in the 2000s. And he goes, no, I did not. And I'm like, you have to call the crime lab right now. Let them know that this is suspected fentanyl, because we didn't have the issues that we have right now. They weren't prepared for it. You have to let people know. It's common sense. You have to let people know. And I can tell you from experience, I was really worried until I got a call back from the lab and said, we got it handled. I thought someone was going to get hurt. And no drug investigation is worth getting someone killed over, especially a good guy getting killed. So it's very important you let people know.
It seems like the discussion of the decon process, of where part of it is someone may want to do something good, but if they're not fully aware of the proper process, they can actually make it worse, cause more harm to themselves, or cause more harm to the other people.
Well, one thing that we have to make sure is, you know, when I talked about skin and people, we very carefully said only soap and water. And the reason I say that is some people will want to use a dilute bleach solution. And while that won't hurt the person individually, the issue that we have with bleach and why we don't often recommend it for use in a decon process for this material is that if it were to get on your skin with bleach, it'll increase its absorption through your skin magnitudes. So the only thing that you would use bleach on would be that end surface where you're only doing residual after, because there's nothing there for you to get onto your skin and making sure it's all there. But you really have got to be very careful if you're going to use any of these higher pH solutions. So if the pH goes above 7, I want to make sure every time you're dealing with it, and until you are guaranteed there's no more material, you are wearing protective equipment.
And one thing I just want to jump on top of that right there, we talk about protective equipment. When that first responder removes their protective equipment, a friend of ours, again, Matty Gutwell, has a procedure he's teaching his people now where if somebody, for example, is searching a vehicle, before that officer who searches their vehicle, they take the PPE off, they dispose of it properly, they use soap and water. Before he gets behind the wheel of the vehicle, he stands there for 15 minutes in case he was exposed or she was exposed, and you have another officer with Narcan there, or a firefighter with Narcan or naloxone, to, if that officer goes down, you don't want to be behind the wheel of a vehicle, and which happens every day in New England. Somebody overdoses behind the wheel of a vehicle. You don't want a good guy to do that. The same thing if you're EMS crews. If you're exposed, you might have to bring somebody else in there because you don't want to get behind that ambulance wheel driving down the road. And that happens.
We've had it happen.
So that's something you got to be prepared about and watch that person for 15 minutes.
So the one thing we want to say, that this is very much dependent upon the way in which you ingest it.
Yes.
Okay?
Absolutely.
So if... which is most likely for you is going to be breathing it in for the first responder community. Breathing it in is going to be happening in 4 to 5 minutes. So we're going to say stay 15, and then we can keep track of. If you ingested it, so you swallowed some and you got it into your stomach, that's going to take upwards to an hour. You may see the first signs and symptoms of 15 minutes. If it went through your skin, and you had a dose that you could, I mean, to get enough through your skin to even notice it takes a lot of material. I'll put out that there first. However, you would be a few hours before even the first little bit got into your bloodstream. That's the amount of time it takes to move across your skin and into the blood. It takes over 24 hours before you reach your maximum of coming through flux. So you've got to remember that the way in which they ingested it tells you a lot about when they're going to be experiencing certain symptoms.
And based on the symptoms of like understanding that peak exposure, how does that impact how you respond and treat the patient?
Well, that brings up a whole different issue. So one of the issues that we have with responding, especially where we have so many people still using pills, if you use Narcan, so let's say we have a person who took a pill and that first pill did nothing for them. They felt nothing. So they took another pill and that second pill had a whole lot of material in it and they start to overdose. Let's say 15 minutes after they took that pill and we get a call. So we give them Narcan. Narcan's active for about 45 minutes. So if we're saying they were 15 minutes in when we gave them the Narcan, they were an hour in, so 60 minutes when the Narcan wears off. But if they took a pill, their peak exposure doesn't happen till about 100 minutes. So really, we call them frequent flyers. When we have somebody that we have to give Narcan to multiple times, and usually it's day to day, right? In this case, we could be having that same patient back an hour later because they're on the same pill and they just haven't, the Narcan wore off before they reached their peak. So this is why I say if you're dealing with an overdose, you have to know the way they ingested it. If they inhaled it, if they injected it, they're gonna have a couple of minutes at the most to response. But if they swallowed a pill, that's gonna be up to 100 minutes till they reach the maximum. And you're going to need to really respond to that. This is why we say when you're dealing with Narcanning somebody, most people, if you Narcan them and they come back to completely, they don't go transport. Okay? So there's a couple of different options here. Generally, we'll say give them enough Narcan to get them breathing properly.
We've heard Narcan a few times. Can you tell us exactly what is Narcan?
Sorry. Narcan is an antidote. The actual chemical name is naloxone, and it's an antidote for opioid exposure.
Okay.
So, a couple of different things about Narcan. That's the trade name that you generally buy it as. There are 2 milligram and 4 milligram doses that you generally buy. That's intranasal. You could also buy it intramuscular. And it actually, in most ambulances that have a paramedic on board, they have IV Narcan. What that allows them to do is titrate to the exact amount needed. So what I like to do, if you have an overdose, is give them that first bit of Narcan. So use that 4 milligram, that's what our guys use, auto-injector, intranasal, and if it doesn't bring them around, wait 3 minutes to 4 minutes for the nostril to clear out and shoot up the other side with another dose. The minute you come on an overdose where you are using Narcan, and if you do not have an ambulance already en route, get an ambulance en route. The reason I say this is there are no opioids which are Narcan resistant. There's rumors about different opioids being Narcan resistant. If it is an opioid, it is not Narcan resistant. There are people who are Narcan resistant. So if you have a person who has a deviated septum, people who use those APAP breathing machines tend to have a lot of deviated septums with them. People who are chronic cocaine abusers tend to have deviated septums in their nose. They may not be getting the dose up into the brain. It's only going up the nose and out the nose.
And you brought up a good point there. You have to know if your teammates and that have this issue.
Critical it's for your first responders you're yes. working with.
That's something I never thought about until we had this discussion right there. Your partner has a broken nose, you deviated septum. You didn't know that, mm-hmm. and he or she gets exposed. And I think I just want to put that
there's
in.
An intramuscular approach you can get as well. That takes about 5 to 6 minutes to response versus the 3 to 4 for intranasal. But for those people with a deviated septum, it's a great solution. Another thing, if you have never used an auto-injector, I definitely recommend you practice. A way to practice is getting oranges. You may think that it's easy to puncture skin for an auto-injector. Unless you've tried it, you'll be shocked. So try it out on oranges first so that you can see, you know, obviously you can get fake auto-injectors that will you can use for practice. They don't let you just try it on each other anymore. We used to be able to do that in the stations years ago, but not anymore. So please have a couple of different routes. And what I also said, call in your ambulance, because an ALS, Advanced Life Support Ambulance, most of them will carry naloxone in IV form, and they can titrate it to exactly what they need. One other thing to remember, as you're bringing somebody out of an opioid overdose, I recommend getting them on your stretcher or backboard and strapping them down prior to giving them naloxone. If you haven't given naloxone before to an opioid overdose, they can become quite violent. They can also projectile vomit. So a couple of different things to keep in mind when you're doing this. The violence is of the utmost importance. If you are an EMT or a first responder out there, you've been vomited on before. So it'll just be another time. But in this case, you really have to be careful about them becoming very combative. So I say if you can get them tied down first, the law enforcement folks can handcuff or do whatever they need to do if they don't have an ambulance there ready to, but it allow you to have a little bit more safety concern when you're dealing with bringing somebody back. Also, if somebody is not in breathing distress, so by breathing distress, that means less than 8 respirations per minute, then they don't really need naloxone. Okay, naloxone is gonna bring their breathing back up. Other question we have, and I've had this several times from first responders, what if we're unsure? Well, if you're unsure, I say give them naloxone. The reason I say that is there are very few side effects from Narcan naloxone. So if you're unsure that your partner has been exposed, give it to them. You may make them puke, but if they did have an overdose, it will help bring them back quicker. Now, another thing that we've talked about is people using Narcan pre-entry as a just in case. That does not work, okay? It is not meant to be something you use just in case you become in contact.
Can't hide your bed.
Yes.
No.
So just keep that in mind. That is not a tactic or technique that would be recommended by anybody. So, anything else you want to add in there to the Narcan?
No, it's. I think you hit the nail on the head right there.
Intranasal for dogs.
That's a really good point, because you talked about the muscle injector. I know a lot of agencies are using that for their dogs. It's easier for the dogs to administer.
It is much easier.
And I highly recommend you talk to a veterinarian prior you do this and get some training done with where to inject your dogs. When it comes to the law enforcement, because we use dogs in everything. I remember when we first started seeing hydriotic acid being smuggled across the border to manufacture methamphetamine in San Diego. The customs dogs would sniff hydriotic acid and it would destroy their sense of smell. So we told them not to use this. Now let's fast forward to fentanyl. We have narcotics coming across the border, fentanyl, Siegfried, or whatever it is, coming across the border. We're using our dogs. Our dogs get dosed. Or we have canine patrol and doing a pipeline stop someplace in the Midwest. Their dog gets exposed. They have to have the proper Narcan to deal with that. And I recommend the injectable. I'm not a dog handler. I would talk to the veterinarian that you deal with for your dog and see what he or she recommends how to do this, because you can use the nasal for the dogs, but from talking to dog handlers, they like the injectable version better. They said it's easier to administer. But also look at the warning signs for your dog. Becomes lethargic, drools, can't stand up. You know, that's like when I was an agent, that's what I felt like at the end of the day. But, you know, know your dog. Know your people when it comes to if they start acting weird or getting, you think they've been exposed. Know your people. I think that's really important.
I think it's really important with the dogs have been exposed and dogs have been treated with naloxone already in the U.S., mainly in the far southeast. So with that, those were intranasal uses, and you can... just like you would with a human, inject it up the nostril. One thing that I find with dogs is if you blow in their face, they will start to try to snuff. That helps it a little bit. Again, the minute you do that, you get that dog to a vet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for animals, they usually use, instead of naloxone, they use naltrexone, which is another antidote. And so the vet will need to know what you've used. But coordinate with that animal's vet prior to anything. If they are one of your dog canine teams, I think it's a discussion you should have prior to versus later.
Yeah.
And make sure it's there. Yeah, because you don't want to, I mean, this is your partner. You don't want to lose the partner.
We've covered a lot here, and it's been fantastic. I think I want to try and, one last question I want to ask both of you before we maybe go to the next part of our time here at MRI Global is, we've talked about some of these really stark realities that some of us are unaware about, or some of these really crazy trends that are happening. But what is one reason that both of you have to give you a sense of optimism, for sense of how we can better maybe a level of prevent or respond, or what do you have that makes you optimistic about this whole discussion around fentanyl?
For me, is people are talking about it. First responders are training for it. You're seeing partnerships out there between the private and public sector. I feel good about that. It's not like the olden days in a meth lab where no one knew what the heck to do. People are talking about it between the different agencies, the different types of organizations that are out there. I feel good about that. What do I feel bad about? This is not going away. This is going to be here for a while. This is going to be here for a decade. And Christine and I were talking about, and Paul talking about this last night. This is taking out an entire generation of Americans. And it's not just in America now. It's popping up in Europe. It's everywhere. It's not going away. And we have to be prepared to fight the fight. We got to save our generations. And it's not going away. There's too much money in it.
Yeah.
So I think from my perspective, the thing that makes me feeling good about what's going on is that we've been preaching for years now, trying to get people to go from a hazard-based approach to response to a risk-based approach. And I think people are finally taking a common sense, risk-based approach to this problem, where we know the fentanyl is there, but looking at how much, what type of container it's in, and determining how we respond based upon risk factors. I think that is the first time I'm seeing a true risk-based response being employed in the United States. And I love that. The problem that I see, I think I'm going to have to jump right on what Mike said. We are losing a generation in the United States right now. Those main, you know, a huge number of males between 18 and 35, as well as an upcoming population of females, predominantly white in the beginning, and now we're starting to see it go into a lot of Hispanic and African American, and it's taking out a generation of our people, and we caused this. I mean, this was not something. A lot of these people who are going down this path, and that's one thing that we have to remember. Every, you know, I hear it over and over again. Well, they made the choice. Well, not everybody made that choice. Some people, yes, they made that choice. They were going down that path, and they were going for the next best drug. But some people never made a choice. When you look at some of the elderly people that we see that are looking for these drugs because they're addicted and they can't get off of them now. When you look at kids who had their wisdom teeth pulled and are now addicted to drugs. When you look at that star athlete who tore a ligament and got medication for the surgery and is now addicted to drugs. We have taken families that had, they were the family that we held up on a pedestal as everything going for them. And now they're dealing with their child dying from a drug overdose. I've watched it time and time again. I've seen it within my family. I've seen it within my friends' families. It is there and it is coming out to get them. And while I often agree that we can't do everything and save everybody, but I tell you, I'll do my damnedest trying. And I'll definitely do my damnedest making sure we don't lose an emergency responder who is just there trying to help. And to me, that's the importance of what Mike and I do going around teaching, is trying to make sure that the communities know what is your risk, how do you respond safely, and to understand that while, again, this is a threat, but it's a very manageable threat, and deal with it from that approach.
That's so valuable, having everyone here at this table to facilitate and accelerate this discussion, because it's something that's not going away, and I think it's something that's apparent. No one is immune from this problem.
No.
And unfortunately, whether it's, I personally was affected when my friends from high school was a star athlete, got injured, and then he got addicted to it and had died of an opioid overdose about a year ago. And it was one of those things you never thought it could happen until it actually happens. And right. I think until it actually hits home to you, absolutely. It's not one of those things to where it becomes real. And then there's the people who are affected by taking the drugs, and you have to have some level of empathy about why they're taking it. But then also now really focusing on this responder discussion. And I think from hearing from both of you, there's tools out there. There's a lot of the of good best practices and education out there. And we want to connect these dots. And you two seem to be very willing to answer these questions. There's a lot of these different resources we have. So we want to make that available through some of the content that Texas A&M, the Smart Firefighting, is putting out to help provide these resources for those who may not know what to do to start this discussion moving towards, again, how do we move from these hazard-based responses to risk-based responses to make it so we're doing this most effectively, cost-effectively, doing this holistically, and not overshooting anything.
And I think it's great to know that you can contact us individually anytime you have questions, and we'll put our information out there. But you can also get... Mike teaches with a company called NES, and I teach with a company called Federal Resources, and both of us teach programs out there that are out there and ready to teach anybody who needs it the how to respond to these safely and effectively.
And I talking about teaching, I think that everyone who's listening has to be aware that 6 months from now, there's going to be something completely different out there. You have to stay current. As we were joking about this morning, there's no one who's really a subject matter expert on this, because it changes daily. You have to be aware of that. And I think that's very important out there for first responders, because 6 months from now, it could be a completely different animal. Different stuff popping up. And that's just my biggest concern is guys stay current.
Yeah, it's a whole catch me if you can. I mean, the market is going to change, the drug is changing, and as does the response, and we all have to change as well.